This is Booktown. You're new here, aren't you? Maybe I should show you around. You can get anything you want here. Anything you want. Anything you desire. Anything you can imagine. It's all here. It's all free. It's all for you. Come on. I'll show you around. If you've got the guts. This is Booktown. You can get anything you want here. Anything you need. This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome. I'll be with you till 2 o'clock, talking first about a book that is trying to change society, and then about some people and how they go about making books themselves. These are production editors. Well, they have quite a few. They do book publishing services, and we're going to find out how that can be done in Nevada County. To start with, I'm going to be talking for the next 20, 25 minutes or so with Michael McGonigal, who's a co-founder of Greenpeace International many years ago and a law professor, environmental law professor at the University of Victoria in British Columbia. He's just published a book called Planet U, Sustaining the World, Reinventing the University, which is published by New Society Publishers. I should say the book is actually by Michael McGonigal and Justine Stark, but it's Michael McGonigal we'll be talking with right now. Welcome to Booktown.
Well, thank you. Good to be here, Eric.
Thank you. When I first received this book, or when I first heard about it and decided it was one that I might want to feature on this program, I had a feeling, I was slight hesitation because I thought it might just be a feel-good book telling about how wonderful universities are, and if they just become sustainable, the world will change. It turns out it's much more complex than that, and you talk a great deal about the problems in society, the problems in universities, and you even start out by saying you're not quite sure what sustainable means.
Uh-huh. Well, that's good to hear all that, because our concern with this book is that people will see that it's about a university or universities generally and kind of put it in the same level of interest as a discussion of the principles of accounting, right? Because people see the university, they don't even think about the university, really. So to understand the importance of the university and the complexity of where it comes from, what it's doing, what its potential is really what this book is about, I think, exactly that.
And you say in one way that universities have gone through several changes over the last 1,000 years and have really taken three different forms. What are those?
Well, yeah, and first of all, I mean, just when you start thinking about the university and realizing that it is this institution that has continued in unbroken operation since the 12th century, that's itself quite significant. But the scholar and actually Arizona State University, Marcus Ford, who wrote a very interesting book recently, he talks about these three periods, kind of the theology period when the first five centuries of the university's existence in Europe was, you know, under the Roman Catholic Church, and the focus was theology, and that was the mother of all sciences. Then shifting to a second period, he talks about in the sort of 1600s, with the rise of the state and colonization and creating armies and navies and expansion and the rise of, you know, capital markets and trade and so on. So it becomes much more of a state-oriented institution, helping to teach engineers how to build bridges and sailors how to sail. But now talking, he says, a third period, which is since the 50s, 40s and 50s, since the Second World War, of what he calls economism. The university is really plugged into the growth economy, the job market, producing good engineers again, but good consumers and producers. So the age of economism is what he says we're in now with the university.
And you say at one point that we really, that is the modern world, and we have to go into a postmodern world, a postmodern university.
Well, yeah, that it's interesting. That term postmodern puts a lot of people off, right? It's kind of a highfalutin term, and some people see it as a very negative one. But really what that means is that the modern world that we have built up, that we can continue to expand, that progress is right in front of us, and it's just the sort of 50s version of the world, which a lot of universities were founded in that period, the 50s and 60s, that we know that doesn't work anymore. You know, that climate change and military conflicts and oil price rises and traffic congestion in cities and the disparity between rich and poor and developed and underdeveloped countries, developing countries, is like making people, the clash of civilizations, if you want, making people realize that our old modern version of reality has to change. And what does it mean if we're going to get past that? And the university, we think, is just, for a zillion reasons, able to lead the charge in getting past some of the problems of modernism.
And one of the main reasons you explain is that universities are, in a way, sort of schizophrenic, in that they are all rooted in a very specific place, but they're part of a worldwide network of institutions that do more or less the same thing.
Yeah, well, and I think one of the main points of this book is to get the reader to recognize what we call the importance of the higher education industry. And that's what we argue here, is that the higher education industry, universities and colleges, is the number one industry on the planet. It may not be the largest in absolute numbers, but, you know, the U.S., the one recent study, $1.2 trillion in economic impacts annually from the university system. You know, 20 million Americans are either part-time or full-time students or faculty or staff in universities. Huge numbers. And so this big-scale industry, but as you say, it's also very rooted in place. Universities are very specific to their place, and as an economic actor, that's very important. A lot of cities throughout the world, and particularly in Europe and North and Western Europe and North America, a lot of cities have colleges and universities where they are the number one economic player in their region. So if they start to change and say, we want to make ourselves models of a postmodern world, which is more just, more sustainable, and so on, they can make big changes right where they are. And that's very, especially given their clout and expertise and numbers of students and so on.
You start many of your chapters with instances of protests or conflict between universities and their environments, not all of which were successful. Like your first chapter, you begin with a tree sitting at your school, the University of Victoria, where the students were not successful in changing, well, in getting their immediate demand fulfilled.
That's right. Well, there is already a sustainable campuses movement, very low level in the sense that it's not really in the public consciousness. And when we first started working on this issue in our own university, we thought we were the Christopher Columbus of campus sustainability, Christopher Columbi of campus sustainability. We didn't know anything was going on anywhere, and that was only 5 or 6 years ago. But it's been around. It's very, very kind of low level in sense of focusing on specifics like how to make buildings more energy efficient or how to get better transportation planning for their universities. Very significant issues, but kind of specific ones, technical ones. And what we found is that there are conflicts, such as the tree sit at our university or the tree sit last summer at Cornell, which is also unsuccessful. conflicts about the whole direction of the university. What is its mission? And how can it take these specific things like better transportation planning and more efficient buildings or using buying local foods rather than long distance food? How can we take all those possibilities for the university, curriculum redesign and so on, and actually change the university much more broadly than just little bits? And that is very difficult. That's conflictual. That makes people have to re-examine what the university is all about and what our roles as academics or students or administrators or members of a municipal of a community with a university in it, what our roles are. Really opens up a lot of possibilities.
And you point out that universities are one of those places where people expect democratic responsibility, I guess you say, but traditionally they have not been. They've been very hierarchical and rather authoritarian.
Well, yes, and I think the university, you talked about it being schizophrenic, I think probably the major split in the university is between what faculty and academics are allowed and students are allowed to kind of talk about and think about and write about, and what the universities actually physically do. So the university has this reputation, well-justified reputation, as kind of a public space where, you know, conflict and dialogue and democracy and, you know, students writing in newspaper, there are student newspapers with all these new and crazy ideas, and faculty can be outrageous and say, you know, critical things, and people are free to invent and be creative in their thinking. That is definitely one side of the university, very important. But when it comes to how universities physically operate, how decisions are made about new buildings or parking lots or the budget, it's very hierarchical and very old-fashioned. I mean, you've got business schools teaching about innovative corporations, and then the corporation of the university itself is not, from a business or administrative point of view, it's often not very innovative at all.
Yes, I was a little disappointed to read about the failure of the tree sit at University of Victoria, but I was really shocked at what happened at Cornell. I think a lot of people around the country think of Ithaca sort of like Madison or Berkeley or Boulder as one of those really ecologically minded, innovative communities where everybody knows what the problems are and how to solve it. Yet the Cornell administration destroyed magnificent old trees to build, of all things, a parking lot. I couldn't believe it.
Well, and it's, you know, having, when we were writing this book last year at this time, and this conflict was going on, it was actually in June of last year, and we were back and forth on the phone talking to the people involved in this, and it was very painful to hear about it. I mean, as people may recall, this time last year in the East Coast was a heat wave, and it was hot, hot, hot. And here are these kids up in these tree sits, up in the trees, surrounded by police, 24 hours a day, spotlights on them, in the heat, no food being allowed up to them, no water being allowed, no safety equipment, generators going 24 hours a day to keep the spotlights going, in order to force them out of the trees so they could cut the trees and build a parking lot. Now, the irony of this is, all for us, was all the way through the book, we were citing examples of places, you know, whether it's in Berkeley or whatever, but several were from Cornell in terms of watershed restoration, transportation planning, so good specific practice. But when it came right to the crunch in a case like this, it was completely conflictual between an administration that insisted on new parking lots and students and faculty and also members of the community of Ithaca itself, which unsuccessfully had two lawsuits against Cornell to block its construction. They lost. So there was when it came to the crunch, the governance structure of Cornell did not serve innovation well at all. On the other hand, an example close to home where you are was in Berkeley. Same time, it was coming up in the newspapers, there's going to be a big conflict between University of California at Berkeley and the town of the city council in Berkeley over the same sorts of things, you know, expansion of the campus. And that was resolved because the leaders in Berkeley and the leaders, the mayor, Tom Bates, in Berkeley, worked out an arrangement that allowed the university to integrate much more constructively in the community. Transportation planning, community economic development, shared decision-making, exactly the sorts of things that need to happen in spades all around North America and the rest of the world.
You mentioned that there are a good number of universities now that have essentially sustainability officers. I don't know what title you exactly want to give them. Do you think these are really, or to what degree do you think these are sincere, and to what degree do you think they are just PR?
Well, they certainly serve a PR purpose for the university, and every university that has a sustainability coordinator and does sustainability initiatives uses it for fundraising and for public relations, no question about it. However, I think sustainability coordinators inside the universities, in particularly in North America, which is where they exist, are very important. I mean, they are, as we show through a whole bunch of examples in Harvard and Columbia and Berkeley and University of Victoria and other places, the coordinators are just dynamos. I mean, they see all kinds of possibilities, whether it's, you know, monitoring the energy consumption in student dorms so they can have competitions between the students in the dorms to be more energy efficient. Lots of stuff you can do there. So they're very sincere, but again, they're placed in a bureaucracy where they really have no power, no very low limited budget in most cases, and very rigid kind of reporting line, so that if their boss doesn't like what they're doing, it's game over for a specific initiative. And some of those initiatives are costly in the short term and challenging. And what we argue is you need to move it up a notch, way up. That it's the whole way in which sustainability decisions are made in the university has to go much, much higher up.
Your last chapter is a jump into the future, where you foresee in 2015 many of these things have been accomplished, but it's the shortest chapter in the book, and you don't really say how you think they will be. How do you think they will be?
Well, I agree. I mean, it's a visionary chapter, and it's kind of just what it could look like, but I think we set out in a few places where the sorts of changes need to be made and how we get there. I mean, for one, imagining designs in university decision-making, we talk about this very particularly, and Yale has done this in other areas, but different designs for university decision-making. Like, we talk about a vice president for planning, innovation, and sustainability that's totally responsive to community pressures and decision-making, so really a different type of decision-making. But then also, really the importance of this new movement, of democratizing discussion, of people actually, and this is what we really want to do with this book, is get people really to look at the university, pay attention to it. It's not just a boring institution. It's the backbone and the most important industry on the continent, on the planet. And we coin a phrase, the planetary university. We say every university should be a planetary university, which is to say a university that consciously models, shapes itself in its place as a model of planetary sustainability. So it's not just about one change or other. It's a whole consciousness change about what the role and character of the university is. And that's a big challenge. We actually would even argue, and this is a really big claim, that we need a university's movement now every bit as much as we needed the environmental movement 40 years ago, or even the civil rights movement. We need a movement that really recognizes what huge power is in this institution that we're ignoring.
This is Booktown on KVMR FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, talking with Michael McGonigal about his book Planet U, co-written with Justine Stark. You come up with a strategy which you call comprehensive local innovation. How does this work?
Well, that phrase is kind of adapted from some of the business literature, and ironically, that we look at a lot of the literature on corporate innovation. And what we say about the university is that it's, first of all, it is a place. And so you look at one of its unique aspects as an industry. It's got more real estate in a local area with more money and expertise attached to it than any other industry, any other institution. So we say, why don't we take that idea seriously, that local place, and just say you put a border around a university campus, and we say that we're going to do everything that's comprehensive, everything inside that local border differently. We're going to innovate on every level with energy, transportation, food, curriculum, decision-making, even pension fund investments, to make that local area state-of-the-art. And Eric, you mentioned earlier about how these local places are also networked globally. That's one thing universities can do beautifully. What making linkages with other universities, and this is what's happening, this is happening now, but really driving, making linkages with other universities to say, well, who is doing the best UPass planning so that students are getting free transportation and city buses? Or who is doing the best local purchasing of organic agriculture to support small farms in the region? And how can we adopt this here? So innovation networked through the university comprehensively on all its range of activities to make that local area a model of sustainability.
You mentioned that Europeans in this regard look toward North America and especially toward the United States as the leaders in this movement, but then you point out that the leading is going rather haltingly.
That's right. That's right. And that's, again, why I think to try and propel this movement is the urgent need, so that sustainability coordinators have much more clout inside the university administrations, so that students get much more actively involved, so that municipal counselors and other members of communities where universities exist and are present, and that's a lot of places, realize that this is a communal asset. It's not just an institution, often a specific part of town that pumps out students with degrees that can go get jobs. This is a very important local institution. We should use it more. So the sustainability coordinator, they've only been around for a few years, so it's a start, but we've got a long way to go, and there's lots of avenues to get there.
And, of course, one of the dangers is in institutionalizing innovation. It can suddenly turn very sterile.
Well, you know, that's a very, very good point, Eric. And a lot of people kind of raise their eyebrows when you talk about, as we do, the need for a vice president for innovation. That is a problem. But it's a problem of how you design it. So if you have senior administrators who actually have to pay attention, like it's designed so that they have to listen to their, you know, their advisory boards that are have members of some of the community students and so on, and not top down, very bottom up, that can make a difference. The best example of that we have is at Yale. I mentioned earlier they have a vice president for New Haven and State Affairs. It's kind of an interesting title, but the reason for that is because New Haven, you know, a relatively small city, 110,000 people. Yale, a relatively small university, like 12,000 students, but with a budget of $1 billion a year. The salaries coming out of Yale are like $900 million, almost $1 billion a year, into that little city of New Haven. So they realized the social impact of the university was huge, and they started working in neighborhoods, education programs, all kinds of linkages with New Haven on the social side. Not specifically the environmental side, because they see that and how important that is. And that's at the vice presidential level. So there's one example of pushing it up a bit.
And, of course, New Haven, that's a classic example of a very wealthy university in a not very wealthy city.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And to think that $1 billion a year is going through there in salaries, and the university, which has departments on, you know, economics and social development and planning and architecture and, you know, all kinds of different departments where they teach all kinds of neat stuff. And the university itself is finally going, just a second, maybe we should be doing some of this stuff and applying it. I mean, it's so obvious. It's amazing that that should happen, but it's so rare.
I actually know very little about the University of Victoria community and what's going on there, but I was very impressed by your publisher, New Society Publishers, which is also on Vancouver Island, is that correct?
Right.
And they have a very large list of books so far in topics about new societies, and they are among the people who definitely walk their talk. The book is 100% post-consumer recycled paper, and they say on their website that they are the first carbon-neutral publisher in the world.
Yes, well, New Society is a great publisher. Interestingly enough, it originally was in Philadelphia, and it was, for many years, it was the offices were shared between Philadelphia and Vancouver Island, but now it's purely in Vancouver Island. So a Canadian takeover of an American industry. And they're very oriented to practical changes, both in urban areas and more broadly. A lot of very interesting books recently on the whole peak oil issue and climate change and so on. Very practical. Lots of good books, and they're easily available on the web, newsociety.com, I think. So, a great publisher.
Yeah, and I actually, did you have anything to do with getting them to move there?
No, that's long before my time.
Yeah, and actually one of their authors, Richard Heinberg,
right.
Spoke in Nevada City, or in Grass Valley, where we are, not too long ago, and we have a new organization called Apple, which is for a post-petroleum local economy, which was very much inspired by his talk.
Oh, that's good. Well, maybe I should come down there and talk to university.
Yeah, we only have a community college right now.
Well, that's the same thing. Community college, universities. My guess is it's a pretty big player in your city too, is it not?
It's only been here for a dozen years, so it isn't yet, but I think it will be as time goes on.
Well, how many students?
Oh, that's a good question.
I'll bet if you look at the impact of that on transportation in particular, which is a very direct impact of having students coming to and for the university, that it has a significant role in your region. I mean, in Portland, which is a very big city, part of the reason that Portland has met the Kyoto standards and has done so relatively easily, is because Portland State University helped them get new transportation system with a lovely, tram in downtown Portland and feeder train systems into it, subway systems into it. So, the small absolute size of the university or college in a town actually frequently has much more clout than seems to be on the surface.
Well, thanks so much for talking with us. This time has gone very quickly, but I highly recommend Michael McGonigal's Planet U, Sustaining the World, Reinventing the University, which has just come out from New Society Publishers.
Thank you, Eric. Most enjoyable.
Okay, thank you.
Okay, bye-bye.
This is Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. I'm Eric Tome, and I'll be here till 2 o'clock talking about books and bookmakers of one sort or another. A sort of bookmaker that I didn't even know existed actually came into my store to sell me some books sometime last year. I was very impressed by the books, and it turned out that they were ones that she and her husband had produced. They are... Well, the nomenclature changes so much, I'll let them explain it. But with me this afternoon are Joan Keyes and John Peck of Dovetail Publishing Services. How long have you been in Nevada County, and what exactly do you do?
We've been here about 3.5 years. We're hired by publishers who typically turn over a manuscript to us to have it designed, edited, illustrations prepared, page layout occur, and then all the liaison with the printer that yields bound books.
And that's what surprised me, because I always thought publishers did that in-house, that they had their book designers and their editors and printers and so on, but that they had their own staff who did those things. And is this a sudden change in publishing, or has it been always been this way and I just didn't know it?
I think it's a pretty... It's actually been a gradual progression. It used to be that publishers all did it that way, but I think back in the 90s, the bigger companies started jobbing it out, realizing that they could save money by not having staff. I think a lot of the small independent publishers still have a lot of those people on staff, and a lot of freelancers are used as well.
And how did the two of you get into this? I have a feeling you also eased into it gradually.
I started in a bookmaking career in about 1972. I worked for a fairly large company that did just book composition on fairly specialized equipment that evolved into the desktop revolution that everybody's fairly familiar with nowadays. I ran a company of my own from 1977 until 1996, during which time Joan and I worked together. And I closed that company due to the impossibility of keeping up with the evolution of technology in the non-desktop arena. And Joan and I have worked together. Joan started Dovetail in 1996, and I joined shortly thereafter after closing the company that I just referred to.
What do you mean, the non-desktop arena?
Well, time was when in the pre-microcomputer world that the technology for managing text and doing the things we do now on Macintosh computers was done on highly specialized mini computers. A system for doing what we do now typically cost between $80,000 and $150,000 for four workstations, and was considerably less flexible than what we and others can do now on their microcomputers with the right software.
Yeah, there was hundreds of thousands of dollars of worth of specialized equipment before desktop publishing. You know, typesetting equipment, image setting equipment, various kinds of proofing equipment, and all of this would go to the printer as film, where they would make plates. And even now, most printers don't make plates. They go electronically directly to plate. Computer to plate, it's called.
And in those days, you had to be close to the physical objects, whereas now...
Correct.
Do you, when you are at a particular stage in book production, do you send your draft or your status report, do you send it by email, do you send CDs, or do you go to the city?
Well, we do all of the above, but increasingly it's just the exchange of initially, the author's Word files and various different types of files, depending on what kinds of illustrations are involved, culminating in PDF files going back and forth. This is probably going to be the first year where we don't do a lot of paper proofing in favor of the PDF workflow. It's more economical for everybody. I'm not sure that it's progress. As much as we look at computer screens, I don't think we're really that fond of making that all we look at 8 hours a day, and I think we'll miss handling paper,
yeah,
and interacting with paper.
But then you do get the books in the end.
Yes, you do. But you know, I think we're in love with this business because of the printed book, and. Many of the books, we've done a lot of college textbook work in our life, and a lot of that is going digital, you know, and custom publishing, and so they don't have to produce those big paper books anymore. Hopefully for us literature readers, we'll never have to lose the texture of a book in our hands.
And you brought some of your books with you. The two I can read well from the other side of the room are McMurray's Organic Chemistry and Helen Gardner's Art Through the Ages. Mm-hmm. But then there are a couple of smaller ones. I guess you handle all sorts of projects.
Yes, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And is there a typical gestation period for a book?
I think it really varies pretty wildly. That Gardener's Art Through the Ages is an enormous tome of over 1,000 pages of four color with magnificent art in it, and that's probably a 2-year project each edition. But that smaller book on the top, you know, some of the smaller ones, they can be 6 months, maybe even less.
And you don't always undertake the entire process. Sometimes you just do part of it and farm some of it out, or?
That's true. Correct.
Yeah.
Are there parts of it you like more than others? Is there some part you always want to farm out, like proofreading or?
Yeah, proofreading puts me to sleep, really, it does. But so that's not something we generally do in-house. But I love laying out the pages and doing the typography, and we don't always get to do that, maybe 40% of the time.
40% of the time you actually get to do the book design.
Well, the design and the layout are different. You know, the design is choosing the trim size of the book and the font that will be used and the elements. And then usually the designer's job ends there, and then it's the typographer's job to see that design is consistently followed throughout the book and when you lay out the pages and decide where the art will go and things like that.
But you do all of those steps.
Or yes,
sometimes
we can.
Do all of those. You can do all of those. And I think you said just before you came on that the Art Through the Ages, which you sold to me and which I actually gave to my daughter for Christmas, to her great delight, is only a few years old, and now you're coming out with a new edition?
Yes, but that one perhaps is a year old, and the next edition won't be out until 2008. So that's the several-year process. So we took a year off, and there's quite a few subtitles to that book. They break it down into smaller volumes for shorter classwork.
Now, I have one of my co-workers is a former, he was mostly a textbook dealer near San Francisco State, and he still sells used textbooks at high prices. He claims that they frequently just revise textbooks just so they can sell a new edition.
There's a case to be made for that, and it's a not as simple as it looks on the surface commercial web. Publishers invest tremendous amounts of money in a first edition and all the ancillary products that the college community really demands, both print and electronic. And they try to cover the costs of all that with the primarily the textbook. A lot of the ancillary stuff is a giveaway. And on the one hand,
you mean like teachers' editions and
yes. And on the one hand, the used book industry seems like it provides nice relief for students and a good way to recycle books. On the other hand, they make profits that don't go back into the development of new books, thus putting more pressure into or onto what publishers have to charge to cover their development costs. So it's very not straightforward in terms of who's really benefiting in the used book market. I think it's mostly the used book dealers who are probably making more profits than the publishers without coming back to the market with any new or innovative product.
But there are many publishers who have trade and textbook divisions, and quite often it's the textbook division that they know they can predict their profits from that pretty reliably, whereas trade books are a lot harder too.
Certainly that's true. And especially with books that are in the market for a long time, we work with a lot of books that are, you know, 4th, 5th, 6th, 7th edition, and they're in their 6th or 7th edition because they've been in demand through that many editions. They're textbooks that clearly dominate their fields in terms of excellence, and so they survive through that many editions.
Mm-hmm. And you by now are pretty well known, I guess, in the book business, so you don't have to. When I Googled you, the two of you, I didn't find too many recent references, and you said that could be because you don't need to advertise.
This is true.
So you're very lucky. You can live where you want, and the work, I wouldn't say pours in, but do you turn down many projects?
Yes, but we're in touch with our customers in such a way that the offers are orchestrated. They know in advance whether we will or won't take a project.
Mm-hmm.
We're actually facing a fairly ominous bit of competition from companies in India right now, because despite the fact that there seems to be a language barrier, that's what most people experience when they experience services provided from there. There's a, you know, there's a very well-educated workforce there who can do this work for much, much less than we can. So that's our, that's the shadow that we're under right at this point.
I know for many years you could instantly identify a book that came from India by the typography and the paper and the binding, all of which were pretty shoddy. And but I've seen a few recent books that are quite magnificent.
Yeah, I think there's been quite a change, and oftentimes books that go to India are still managed by people in the United States, so that can be mitigated. Quality control is on this side.
Are there particular publishers you particularly like working with? I'm not asking you to name names, but
sounds like it. No, actually, we have some great clients. Wadsworth Publishing is a division of Thomson Learning. Peach Pit Press was a new client for us. We've been doing a lot of their like Adobe manuals and other kinds of software manuals. Backbeat Books, a new client for us, is really fun to work with, and your audience would particularly like it because they're a music book company. Josie Bass, Barrett Kohler, business book publishers largely. And recently we've taken a local client where we're doing the catalog work for Peaceful Valley, which is a really nice organization to work for.
When you have a job like this, how do you split up the labor? Do you work on books together, or do you tend to each work on a separate one?
We tend to work on separate projects, and or take parts of the same project where I'll do the project management and Joan will do the page layout, or vice versa. We don't tend to share the same task on the same book.
Our customers prefer one source, one contact, so we try not to.
And one person they know is responsible.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
And you say that you particularly like, Joan, you like the layout.
Mm-hmm.
And John, what's your favorite?
I think I like that too. I also like to do the design and art preparation as needed for the books that we do.
Actually, part of the joy of our job really is getting to know the authors and making them happy. That's a big part of what we do, is make sure that the authors have all the tools they need so that they can do their job, which is to write. And so if they're technically challenged, we help them in that regard. And just getting to know them, they're mostly wonderful people.
So most of the book, I imagine you don't do much fiction, because there's not much besides the typography in designing
right.
a fiction book.
It's pretty true. It's not a market we've sought out, but we wouldn't be adverse to it.
But generally, you do illustrated books and books with tables and
right.
diagrams and this and that.
Right. When Jonathan had his company in Santa Cruz, we were pretty much a math and chemistry organization. So we were specialized in that.
And you just slipped into things like Art Through the Ages through knowing the publishers.
Right. And they bought, some of those publishers bought smaller publishers and then gained their list. For instance, that Wadsworth art title, it used to be Harcourt, and then Thompson bought Harcourt, and so that list became theirs. And
you talk about competition from India. How about within, say, the Western Hemisphere? Is this a field that people are continuing to enter? Because I know a lot of people at one point liked the actual feel of the type, the feel of the paper, as you both said, the smell of the type. Is book design, book production, less enticing than it used to be?
I would say probably so. I think that opportunities to start a career now in book publishing are probably diminished compared to what we found when we started our careers. One of the sadder reasons that this is true is that there are fewer and fewer publishers publishing in the United States. There may be many, many imprints that people recognize individually, but those companies are most often owned by a larger company, and the processes by which they make their books are much less varied, and there's just less speciation in the industry, which means that I think opportunities are probably fewer than existed 20 years ago, 10 years ago. I think a lot of the jobs that somebody who was inclined to be a bookmaker 10 years ago, that same energy might be well applied to preparing content for the World Wide Web or some such. It's the same fundamental.
Except you don't get to touch the paper.
Right.
It's just that the tactile rewards of the job we've loved for so many years is those are not the rewards that one gets when one prepares web content or designs web pages or does some kind of electronic version of publishing.
And there's also a lot more self-publishing now and a lot more vanity publishing. Mm-hmm. I can usually identify about 20 feet away a book that's been, I don't even know the names of all these publishing software programs, but the look is unmistakable. And it's not very appealing for mm-hmm. the most part. Mm-hmm. It's shiny and I'm trying to think of a good description of so many of these books that have been done with through the program rather than through the individual's talents.
Well, let me
ask. So, I guess I might mostly say they're very shiny, they're very slick, but they're quite lifeless.
Yeah, I think that just because you can self-publish doesn't mean that you're going to get a result that appeals to the reader. That really does take some training. I sometimes wonder if a computer program that manufactured clothing had been sold broadly over the last 10 years, how some people would be walking around looking. I mean, just because you can make a suit for yourself doesn't mean you really want to.
Yeah, there's a lot of nuance, I think, in bookmaking, and I think a lot of people who choose to self-publish are actually pretty smart to do so, given the opportunity to sell on the web and have custom publishing so you don't have to print and store many, many copies of your book somewhere. However, they really don't necessarily have the skills to be designers and editors, and they don't realize how important that is to the sale of a book.
Do you think these sorts of books are going to be around in 20 years, 50 years, 100 years?
Do you mean college textbooks?
I mean books that you hold in your hands as opposed to e-books.
I do. I'm going to have faith on that one. I just don't think people are going to be willing to completely give that up. Unless, of course, we have just no paper.
Yeah, I can't decide. There's a part of me that looks forward to the time when I will have something that I can hold in my hands that feels vaguely bookish, but that I could have any of 2,000 different titles on and could probably pick my own typeface, and that if on this particular day mm-hmm. I wanted to read something with a Roman face, I could, and on another day a sans serif face. And mm-hmm. I don't know if I would like it in the long run, but I can't wait till I get the chance to experiment.
I think that product is probably coming. I don't think that readers are going to accept something that doesn't have some reward to hold in your hand. Many will, for various purposes, training or product manuals and so forth, probably won't match the same standard that you apply to the book you repair to bed with at night, but. Mm-hmm. I think the product will be developed that is pleasing to hold in your hand and read.
Yeah, I was sort of like the day when I could have a library of 5,000 books on one tiny shelf.
Mm-hmm.
And then I could get rid of, I don't have to have such a big house and so on. But it's not, but I have friends who read books on PDAs and I can't stand doing that.
I can't either.
You've been in this area 3.5 years, you said, and recently, Joan, you've gotten involved with Literature Alive.
Right, yeah, I'm a new board member, I'm proud to say. And they're a great organization that tries hard to bring wonderful authors from out of the area to the area for reading and also the wonderful local authors that are here. We have a great event coming up in September. Amy Tan is going to be here, and we'll be speaking or reading from at the Veterans Hall on September 21st. Tickets will be going on sale in July, and will be available at Bookseller and Harmony Books and various other outlets to be determined. So invite everybody to check out the website, www.litalive.org, that's LITALIVE.org, for more information.
And I guess you've got a fundraiser coming up, too?
Oh, yes. Also, on, July 15th, Saturday, we'll be doing the second annual yard sale called the Pilfered Moose at Julie Cobden's house in Nevada City, and hope people will come out to buy all the great quality items that are being donated for that event.
Okay, well, thanks so much for coming in and talking with us, John Peck and Joan Keyes of Dovetail. I'm trying to think, what's the second
word? Publishing Services.
Publishing Services. I just put your card away because I thought I didn't need it anymore, and it turned out I did. Before I go, I'd like to mention a couple of events coming up. I've already heard about some of these, but I'm going to run through them again quickly. This Thursday, the Nevada County Poetry Series presents poets Julia Connor, Roni Bopla, and Diana Henning. The show begins at 7:30 p.m. with an open mic following. It's at the off-center stage behind the Center for the Arts in Grass Valley, and you can get information at 432-8196. And this Wednesday, the 14th at 7 p.m., Sierra Writers presents Sands Hall, who's going to be talking about tools of the writer's craft at the community room of the Madeline Helling Library just outside Nevada City. This Thursday, the bookseller is going to be introducing Carolyn Singer. This is going to be Thursday at 6:30 p.m. at their store on Mill Street in Grass Valley. She's the author of Deer in My Garden, about gardening in deer-inhabited neighborhoods. On Saturday, the 17th at 3 p.m., the bookseller will also be featuring Kate Perry with her new romance novel, Project Daddy. And then 10 days from now, on June 22nd, they have decided to move their presentation of Gary Snyder from the bookseller to St. Joseph's Hall, and that's going to be at 7 p.m. on the 22nd of June, and he's going to be featuring the reissue of his book of poems from about 15 years ago, Left Out in the Rain. This has been Booktown on KVMR-FM in Nevada City. Stay tuned for Jimmy Accardi's Rock and Roll Party.